It is Thursday, November 6th, 8:06 on this partly sunny morning. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie on the local news hour today. 36, looks like it's going to be a little cooler today in Park City. Right now it's 45 degrees in the Heber Valley. With more on the Wasatch Back Weather Outlook, it's ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Thursday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back. As we go throughout your Thursday, we're starting off with a little morning precipitation, but that will quickly come to an end. Look for a mixture of sun and clouds as we go throughout the day with more sunshine by the afternoon. Temperatures will be much cooler than where they have been the past several days. In fact, high temperatures will likely not get out of the 40s for us in Park City as they go throughout the afternoon on Thursday. The Heber Valley will see high temperatures struggling to climb into the low 50s as we go throughout the afternoon hours. As we move into your Friday, we're looking at partly cloudy skies. A weak disturbance will move by to our north. That will give the slightest chance of an isolated shower across portions of the Wasatch Back. But again, most of us will stay dry. It will be another chilly day with temperatures only in the 40s for highs in Park City, with highs only in the low 50s again in the Heber Valley. As we move into your weekend, we start off with chilly temperatures once again. Morning low temperatures down around freezing. We'll see those highs only in the upper 40s again in Park City, with highs in the low 50s for the Heber Valley. We'll start a little bit of a warming trend, though, as we go into your Sunday with lots of sunshine. Temperatures should climb into the mid-50s for highs in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing to around 60 in the Heber Valley. As we move into next week, your Monday will feature partly sunny skies. We'll see those temperatures in the low 60s for highs in Park City, and we'll see those temperatures jumping into the mid to upper 60s in the Heber Valley. And that's pretty much where we're going to hang out as we go throughout your Tuesday and Wednesday of next week. We'll call it partly sunny skies for really the most of next week. We'll have a big ridge of high pressure settling in across the area, so we'll keep with those above average temperatures. That'll mean high temperatures through the middle of next week, climbing into the low 60s for highs in Park City, and we'll see those highs climbing into the mid 60s in the Heber Valley. Those morning low temperatures will remain into the 30s, so cool mornings but nice afternoons heading into next week and dry conditions. Let's look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Coming up later on the program, we're going to be speaking with University of Utah Professor of Political Science Josh McCrane about the 2025 election. Then U.S. Speed Skating Executive Director Ted Morris has more on the Salt Lake City World Cup event this month leading into the Milan Cortina Games. And then Rick Bruff and Destiny Gross have a rundown of this season's Sundance Gems series featuring films from across the decades recommended by members of the community. Then at 9 a.m., it's Cool Science Radio on Thursdays. Scott Greenberg and Lynn Ware Peake speak with astrobiologist Caleb Scharf, who explores how humanity's expansion into space represents a profound new phase in the story of evolution. Then geoscientist Gabriel Bowen explores new research revealing the extent to which human activity has fundamentally altered the chemistry and water balance of Utah's Great Salt Lake. That's today at 9 after the local news hour. News next. Ryan Dickey has widened his lead in the Park City mayoral race to 11 votes, while Tana Tolley and Diego Zagara are ahead in the council race. KPCW's Grace Dorfler has updated election results.
The Summit County Clerk's Office released updated numbers Wednesday afternoon, showing Councilmember Ryan Dickey has opened a slightly larger lead in the race for Park City Mayor. In the updated numbers released shortly after 3 p.m. Wednesday, Dickey has 1,701 votes compared to Rubin's 1,690. Although it's still a tight race, it's a bigger difference than the numbers released Tuesday night, when Dickey was just 2 votes ahead of Rubin. Both Dickey and Rubin told KPCW Wednesday they wanted to wait for more information before commenting on the race. The results of the Park City Council race are more defined. Wednesday's results show incumbent Councilmember Tana Tolley has a commanding lead in the field of 3 candidates. She and political newcomer Diego Zagara will fill the 2 open seats on the council. Tolley said she's grateful to win a second term in her hometown.
I am ecstatic to get back to work and just really push forward on the commitment I have to my hometown and to the future generations and ensuring Park City still remains a livable place for all of us. And I'm just so thrilled right now.
She said she's excited to spend the next 4 years working on projects from transportation solutions to planning for the 2034 Olympics. And she praised everyone who entered the race.
I really love to see new people wanting to get involved in everything we do as a community. It just makes us much more stronger and a better place for everyone to live.
Zagara said he's grateful to become the first Latino council member in Park City history and share his perspective on the concerns of workers, young people, and immigrants.
This moment does not go unnoticed to me, and I'm just overjoyed with the level of trust and support the community has put in me.
He said he's looking forward to working with the council over the next 4 years.
The lens could be locals first, visitors welcome. I want to make sure that we are prioritizing affordability and sustainability in the work that we do over the next few years.
Councilmember Jeremy Rubel was unsuccessful in his bid for a second term. He wasn't available Wednesday afternoon, but in a statement on his website, he said serving on the Park City Council has been an honor. About 63% of eligible Parkites, over 3,400 of the city's 5,400 registered voters, headed to the polls this November. Even though all ballots have been processed, the results are not yet final. The clerk still needs to verify some signatures, a process known as curing ballots. And it's possible more overseas ballots could still arrive. That means the numbers could fluctuate slightly before the results are made official November 18th. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Well, good morning again. I'm Connor Thomas, filling in for Leslie this morning on the local news hour. We heard some local election results, but what about the big picture? On the phone now from the University of Utah is political science professor Josh McCrane. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so, you know, I wanted to talk maybe big picture about the election day on Tuesday and some of the national trends and whether or not we can bring that home and localize it here in Utah, because I'm seeing a lot of national outlets report this leftward swing, and I'm curious if that's something that you and your colleagues are discussing in the days following Tuesday.
Yeah, there was definitely a clear leftward swing across the country in the places that had these very kind of politicized elections. There's the obvious ones, such as New York's mayoral race. We also had some big elections in Pennsylvania. The elections in Virginia were unprecedented in the modern era, the degree to which the Democrats have taken control of the Virginia House of Delegates. We saw the redistricting proposition in California win really handily. These would all be things that I think the Republicans are probably very concerned about coming into the midterms next November.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm sure Democratic, strategists are probably claiming victory and saying this is a repudiation of the GOP status quo of the past 2 years. But you're an academic. How do you measure something like that? And how can we say what caused how people voted this year?
Yeah, good question. I mean, so it's pretty typical for there to be a pushback against the party in power in the midterm elections. This, of course, was not a midterm election, but it is preceding one. So that's typical. I think, you know, this is indicative of the degree to which the fundamentals, so that's usually what we talk about, is like the fundamentals. You can think about this as like presidential approval, as the economy, those sorts of underlying indicators. These all are very, very bad for Republicans. So even, you know, considering the fact that the out party usually does worse in the midterms, this all of the indicators would point towards this being a very, very bad time period for Republicans. There's actually a lot of really interesting implications for that, though. So you may have heard about all of the redistricting efforts across the country, right? California is trying to push for redistricting to draw more Democratic seats. And as a response, some of these Republican states like Indiana have been pushing for drawing more Republican seats. This is, of course, going on at the same time as Utah is talking about how to draw its maps. So this is actually really bad news if you're a Republican trying to gain more seats, because in order to draw more Republican seats, you have to make existing Republican seats less safe. And I think this is going to give Republicans a lot of pause given what they've seen here, because they could end up losing a pretty large, by a pretty large majority, the House in the 2026 elections. So that is something I think is going to be a big story here moving forward in the next few months.
And my understanding, and not necessarily with Utah as much, but what happens nationally with redistricting kind of depends a lot on what the Supreme Court does with the Voting Rights Act, right?
I mean, to a degree, yes. The Supreme Court has pretty, this era of the Supreme Court, I should say, has been pretty clear that they don't think the Voting Rights Act applies anymore. They've kind of continuously upheld this. They think it's no longer relevant, right? This was a historical artifact of the Jim Crow era. So they don't really believe that this is something that applies, and they've been pretty clear that they're okay to let states handle this to a pretty large degree. So in the recent past, this has meant that Republicans have been very effective at gerrymandering, drawing districts that favor them. But as, California's pointed out, there's no reason Democrats can't also do that. And so that's kind of where we're at right now, is there's the Democrats are actually doing what Republicans have been really good at doing in the past couple decades.
Yeah, I want to return to what you kind of described as the fundamentals, the things that might, you know, get voters to vote against the current ruling party, so to speak. When was the last time we had an election during a government shutdown? It seems to me like that's having, you know, the largest effect day to day. The headlines today saying we're going to see some air traffic control staffing reductions.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm aware, I don't know when it's been a long time if it has happened before. This has been a pretty unprecedented in length government shutdown. I mean, this is the part where I would say in a previous era, like before the Trump era, this would be considered to be really, really bad politics, right? The Republicans control Congress and the presidency. So they can blame Democrats as much as they want, but voters, like a kind of axiom in political science, is like voters don't care about process. They care about outcomes. And I think it's pretty easy to make the leap that Republicans control everything and we have a shutdown. But I would also point out, like, the politics have been kind of hysterically bad for Republicans. I mean, Trump had this really well-publicized, like, Great Gatsby-style gala the other night with, like, very lavish settings. And meanwhile, they're cutting SNAP benefits to tens of millions of Americans. And they have, you know, millions and millions of federal employees who haven't been paid in over a month. So, like, these kinds of politics just they seem to defy common sense. And you see the same thing with this new FAA-issued cutback of flights. So right after an election where Republicans were seemingly punished for the government shutdown, the Republican-led federal government is going to reinforce the pain Americans are feeling from the shutdown. So not a lot of common sense going on right there.
Yeah, but it strikes me as tricky to say if Utah voters are voting for one political party or another, if we have these nonpartisan municipal races, so many, like the vast majority of the races, if not all, on Tuesday here locally were nonpartisan.
Yeah, I mean, so nonpartisan races are pretty common across the country in local elections. It's sort of a historical artifact. There's actually quite a bit of research about nonpartisan elections. The idea is they're really, really hard for voters to know how to vote. Voters, like, primarily don't pay a ton of attention to politics. And thus, what they have to do is they have to use cues. They have to use, like, what we call heuristics to understand, like, what a candidate stands for. And the easiest to understand cue is what their party is. So we get a lot of weird outcomes in local elections. They're typically low salience, right? So, like, they're kind of low information. People don't know much about them. So it's always hard to figure out what to expect in nonpartisan elections, especially when, you know, these are things that are happening off of a major election cycle and candidates have very, very low name recognition.
It strikes me as, you know, I don't know, it strikes me as better at the local level where, you know, you might not have some of these culture war issues in the day-to-day government. And I'm curious if you have any research on why our county level offices are partisan while our city ones aren't in Utah.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an interesting historical curiosity. I don't think that there's a neat narrative for that. I mean, you know, I think, like, what I would say there is research on is we're actually probably better off having partisan local elections just because it enables voters to have some idea about the policy platforms, right? So if voters don't know what they're voting on per se, and that's very much often the case in these like low salience elections, then it's hard to reward the good kind of candidates and punish the bad ones. So there is quite a bit of a research that would suggest that is important, and especially in this era where, you know, a lot of Utah elections, local elections, are moving towards ranked choice voting, which is probably exacerbating these like information asymmetries that voters have.
That's interesting, because a lot of times the parties are portrayed as these money machines where, you know, you can mm-hmm. it becomes big money politics once these larger organizations get involved.
Yeah, I mean, so again, like local elections, at least, you know, outside of some of these really big cities like New York or San Francisco, tend to be mostly immune from that sort of thing, right? There are like big city elections where there's like one party that's dominant, but in that case, right, the competition shifts to the primary election. This would also be the case in a place like, you know, Salt Lake City, for instance. I think the evidence is pretty clear that nonpartisan elections just make it really hard for voters to know what kind of policy platforms they're getting from their candidates.
All right. I've got one final curveball for you, I think. I'm curious what happens in the event of a tie. We have a pretty close mayoral race in Park City. And then in Charleston, Utah, there's one vote separating a write-in candidate from the incumbent who won a coin flip previously. You know, with these very small city elections, what happens if voters, you know, if it's a dead heat?
Yeah. I mean, so it's usually some like really old law that was passed when there was, you know, like dozens of people that lived in these small towns. So like, you know, the examples are, like you said, the coin flip. I just saw there was an election maybe in Nebraska where it was decided by which candidate drew the higher card out of a deck. It does happen. And that's why voting in these elections really does matter, is like it can really come down to one or two votes. But it is really interesting that we still have elections decided by a literal coin flip.
I like the idea of a floor debate on aces high or aces low.
Exactly.
Anyway, we've been speaking with political science professor from the U, Josh McCrane. Thank you so much for calling in this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
The Park City Council is set to vote on a conservation easement for Clark Ranch today. The developer is looking to partner with Park City Municipal on a mostly affordable housing development near U.S. Highway 40 on the land known as Clark Ranch. The 344 city-owned acres straddle the highway. The development is proposed on about 10 acres on the west. Planning commissioners have so far said the rest is intended as open space, but no formal protections exist. The council could change that.
What staff is coming forward to council with is a 15-acre carve-out, and what we're actually going to suggest to council is to allow up to 10 acres of developable land, and then put the other 5 acres into publicly available open space that will have a deed restriction on it.
That's City Sustainability Director Luke Carton describing a conservation easement which will ban development and subdivision of the rest of the roughly 330 acres, including all of the property east of 40. It would also ban new roads. A staff report states that if approved, the easement would preserve public access for hiking, biking, and winter use. It would also allow weed management, wildfire mitigation, and a potential gondola. The land would be monitored by the nonprofit land trust Utah Open Lands, which would hold the easement. The carve-out for development would be on the west side of US 40, where the Alexander Company has applied to build housing. The council would lock in that location as the only place development is allowed if it approves the easement as drafted. And Park City Municipal is a financial supporter of this station. A Summit County man is pleading not guilty to a felony obstruction of justice charge in a fatal road rage shooting at the Jordan L. Reservoir. KPCW's Jennifer Dobner has this update.
Greg Kyle DeBoer pleaded not guilty to one count of obstruction of justice in 4th District Court Wednesday for his alleged actions related to the death of Hideout resident Patrick Hayes. Hayes was shot and killed during a road rage altercation near the Jordan L. Reservoir in September 2024. DeBoer was arrested 3 months later after he told investigators he shot Hayes, then buried the gun outside his Browns Canyon home. Wasatch County prosecutors charged him with second-degree felony obstruction, but not with Hayes' death. The charge carries a possible penalty of up to 15 years in prison. DeBoer's attorney, Andrew Deesing, entered the plea on his client's behalf, and Judge Jennifer Mabee set a pretrial hearing for January 21, 2026. The plea comes 2 days after a victim's rights committee said the rights of Hayes' family may have been violated by the Wasatch County Sheriff's and Attorney's offices. The group will gather more evidence and meet again in December. In a statement, the county laid out part of its rationale for charging DeBoer with obstruction rather than homicide. Prosecutors said they considered Utah's law that says a person is justified in using deadly force to defend their property, business, or vehicle if they reasonably believe they are being threatened with assault or another form of personal violence. The law also says that defendants in criminal cases who claim they acted in self-defense, as DeBoer did, don't have to prove it. It falls to prosecutors to show that the use of deadly force was not warranted. According to the attorney's office, DeBoer told deputies he followed Hayes from the highway to the state park entrance because Hayes's alleged erratic driving suggested he was intoxicated. DeBoer said before he fired his gun, he feared Hayes would break the window of his car with what looked like a pipe and feared getting his head beat in with a pipe. Investigators later found Hayes was holding a polymer baton and a pocket knife. Jennifer Dobner, KPCW News.
In studio with us now to talk about the upcoming speed skating season is U.S. Speed Skating Executive Director Ted Morris. Good morning.
Good morning, Connor. Thanks for having me.
And of course, you're also a member of our volunteer DJ Air Force, so thank you for your service. So you have an event next weekend at the Olympic Oval in Salt Lake, kind of. It seems like it's setting the stage for the Olympics. What's going to happen next weekend?
Yeah, definitely. This is the first World Cup of four World Cups that will qualify athletes for the Olympic Games. All athletes, not just U.S. athletes, but athletes from around the world. So we're super excited to be hosting it. And as many people know, we have the fastest ice in the world. Most of the world records are at the Utah Olympic Oval. So you're going to have athletes primed up, ready to go. And we expect to see, obviously, super fast times and potentially some world records.
What makes the ice faster than other ice?
Well, ironically, it's not really the ice. It's the air.
Ah, okay.
It's the thin air.
Kind of like football is getting kicked farther at elevation, I see.
Your golf ball going further, all those things.
All right. So who do you expect to attend next weekend from around the world? And do you have any big competitors for those, like myself, who aren't familiar with, you know, the world tour of speed skating?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we're super excited. There are 350 athletes competing, which is, I believe, an all-time high of the World Cup ever, which is fantastic to see those kind of numbers. Obviously, number one nation in the world in long track speed skating is the Netherlands, the Dutch. They'll be there, and you'll see a lot of their fans there dressed in orange with funny hats on and such. But the Italians are a really strong team heading into their home Olympics. The Canadians are always strong. The Japanese have a very good team. Poland has come on super strong over the last couple of years. So there's more balance than there has been over the last, I would say, 20 years in speed skating, with more countries competing for medals.
And a local athlete, Casey Dawson, expected to compete, a YSA alum?
You got it. Yeah, Casey Dawson, Park City's very own, started skating in the YSA program probably close to, almost 20 years ago. And now he's got a Olympic bronze medal from the Team Pursuit in 2022. And currently, as part of the Team Pursuit team, they are the world record holders. And they are also the defending world champions. So pretty much the number one team in the world going in. And the Team Pursuit will actually be on Sunday afternoon next weekend if you want to come down and watch Casey in that. But Casey also is a fantastic distance skater. So he'll be competing all 3 days.
All right. Which other athletes are you or the organization kind of? Where are the American hopes riding on, I guess, this weekend?
Yeah, we're pretty stacked. We feel pretty good about the season and next weekend specifically. We have Jordan Stolz, who's 21 years old and arguably the best speed skater in the world and maybe the most accomplished speed skater, American speed skater, since Eric Heiden, 40-plus years ago. Jordan has won 7 world championship gold medals, and he's only 21 years old. He has come on strong. He made the Olympic team as a 17-year-old in 2022. And he didn't obviously win a medal there, but finished top 20, and now he's going back. And he really is a medal contender in three events going into the Milan Olympics.
Only 21, how long are speed skating careers usually?
It could vary. In long track and short track is different. But in long track, I mean, really what's crazy about Jordan is technically he really won't hit his prime until about 27 or 28 years old, which coincides with the 2034 Olympics right here in Utah. So he's going to be around for a while, we hope, and should be winning a lot of medals throughout that period.
All right, so looking ahead to the rest of the season, you've got Olympic trials for Milan Cortina coming up.
Yeah, so we'll have these four World Cups. We'll be in Salt Lake next weekend, and then the athletes will go up to Calgary for World Cup number two. They'll have a couple weeks off, and then they'll head over to Europe for a World Cup in the Netherlands and Norway. And that wraps up the qualifying events. And then they'll come back here to Salt Lake, do a little training, and then head to Milwaukee for the Olympic trials, which are January 2nd through 5th. And out of that, we'll have our long track Olympic team. They'll come back to Salt Lake City for one more training block for a two-week period. And then they'll head back over to Europe. There's one tune-up World Cup about a week and a half before the Olympics, and then they'll head into the Olympic Village in Milan and off into the races.
How many Olympics have you gotten to attend with U.S. speed skating in your time?
Lucky enough to have been to the last three with U.S. speed skating, but prior to that, I worked for the U.S. Ski and Snowboard Association. That's what brought me out here in 1999. So this will be my seventh Olympics. Now, I wish I could say that as a competitor, but I'll just have to say it as an attendee.
I don't know. You're winning, too, if the athletes win, I think. I feel like I'm winning when they do. You know, any preview, anything that's very exciting to the organization for Italy in particular?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great with the momentum that the Olympics have in general coming out of Paris and the rebound we saw in television ratings and the way NBC presented the Olympics. Now going to Milan, another European location, we're anticipating to see the same kind of bump. The last three Olympics have been tough in Russia, Korea, and China, just from a timing period. Those events were happening live, you know, in the middle of the night for us here in the U.S. Now getting back to more of a standard Olympic Games where it's just a, 8-hour time change for us here, 6 hours from the East Coast, people are going to be able to consume the Olympics in a much different way. So we're super excited about that. Just going back to Europe, too, is going to help a lot. The last two Olympics have been really challenging because a lot of families and friends haven't been able to attend, and that's going to change significantly now, too. So we're really excited about it. We're excited to be in Milan with just hockey and figure skating. Those are the only events. Hockey, figure skating, short track, and long track will be the only events in Milan. Great city. We think they're going to embrace the Olympic spirit, and it's going to be a fantastic Olympic Games.
And probably lots of family and friends, November 14th through 16th. Those are the dates for the first World Cup of the season, again, here in Salt Lake. Where can people find tickets, attend information like that?
You got it. Yeah, so you can go to the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation website, and there's a link there to buy tickets. You can also go to usspeedskating.org, and you'll find a link. Friday's competition starts in the late afternoon, so we're about 4 to 8 p.m. on Friday. We start at 12:30 on Saturday. That'll go to about 3 p.m., and then we're 1 to 4 on Sunday. So you can go to either of those places and get your tickets. Come down and watch these great athletes.
Yeah, and you know, one last thing, the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, we're always hearing, needs money to, you know, maintain these Olympic venues in the run-up to 2034. Is that some of the thought process behind holding some of the World Cup events here in Utah as opposed to elsewhere? But again, you say we've got pretty fast ice.
Yeah, we do. It's amazing what the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation has done with their venues over the last 20 plus years. And actually, we've been hosting World Cups almost every year at the Olympic Oval, both short track and long track. And what's really interesting is that since Salt Lake hosted in 2002, the only other Olympic Oval that's still operating is Beijing. So all the other Olympic Ovals haven't been able to figure out a way to maintain sustainability and actually host World Cup events. And that is such a great endorsement of what the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation has done and what the state has done to keep these venues alive and hosting events. So we're super fortunate that we are able to host those events. That being said, I do want to point out this is the first event that we're hosting since the announcement of the 34 Olympics returning to Utah. So we're really excited about that.
And certainly probably a draw for other athletes who want to start getting used to maybe skating at elevation.
Totally. In fact, we've had most of the world has been training now in Salt Lake at the Oval for the last 2 weeks. They're here because they want to acclimate to the altitude and get some access to fast ice. And there's actually a fun little time trial this Friday where I think 200 athletes are competing. So if anybody is maybe, you know, can't make next weekend and they want to come down and see some of those skaters, come down Friday. I think skating starts about 8:30 in the morning.
All right, you heard it here first. 1 week early access to the World Cup. We've been speaking with Ted Morris. He's the U.S. Speed Skating Executive Director. Ted, is there anything else you wanted to mention for listeners today?
No, I think that's it. Come down, check it out. It's going to be a blast, and go Team USA.
All right, Ted, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, preliminary results in the Charleston election show a margin of just one vote in the mayor's race. KPCW's Grace Dorfler reports the Wasatch County town has a history of unusual elections.
For the 300-odd voters in Charleston, the town that sits on the eastern shore of Deer Creek Reservoir, this year's election is a nail-biter, again. The race between mayoral candidate Jan Wilson and write-in challenger Doug Clements was neck and neck when the Wasatch County clerk released preliminary numbers late Tuesday night. Wilson had 86 votes and Clements had 85. Town clerk Karen Mayer has lived in Charleston her whole life, and she's seen races this tight before, like back in 2017.
It was just tied. I think those were 83-83. It was an even split. And back then they did a coin toss, and the mayor that we have going out now was the one that won the coin toss.
That's incumbent Mayor Brenda Christensen, who was eliminated from this year's election in the August primary. It's not unheard of for a write-in candidate to make such a strong showing in Charleston either. Mayor says several years before the 2017 coin toss, a write-in candidate won the mayor's seat.
I think that the townspeople weren't happy with the choices that they were given, and he was a previous mayor that was not going to rerun again and ended up being written in by the townspeople at that time to come ahead and win the mayor race.
This year's write-in candidate, Doug Clements, hasn't served in government before, but he told KPCW he wants to protect residents' interests and preserve Charleston's small-town culture.
I see, you know, people moving in and coming in from different cultures and trying to bring their culture to Charleston. And you know, Charleston's its own culture. We're just trying to keep it that way.
Like the rest of the town, Clements says he's anxiously waiting to see the final numbers.
You think, you know, what else could I have done to, you know, get one more vote? You can second guess yourself, I guess. But, you know, the cards will be dealt and we'll go from there.
As of Wednesday morning, the county clerk had more than 400 ballots left to count. It's not clear how many of those ballots could belong to Charleston voters. Candidate Jan Wilson did not immediately respond to KPCW's request for comment Wednesday. About 75% of the town's roughly 320 registered voters cast ballots in this year's election, an unusually high turnout in Wasatch County, where overall voter turnout hovered around 48%. Mayor says Charleston had a strong showing at the polls because new leaders could bring big changes to the town.
It's a whole new dynamic, you know, different opinions, different directions.
Since there are fewer than 400 votes cast in Charleston, candidates can request a recount if the results remain just one vote apart when the clerk finishes processing ballots. If there's a tie, Utah law says the winner will be determined by lot, like flipping a coin or pulling names out of a hat. The town is also electing two council members. Michael Bauer and Scott Solemn were in the lead as of Wednesday morning. Elsewhere in Wasatch County, small towns have had election day surprises in recent years. In Wallsburg, two write-in candidates defeated an incumbent town council member in 2023. Grace Dorfler, KPCW News.
Now in studio with me, Destiny Groves and Rick Bruff, who are organizing the Lost Gems of Sundance film series again this year. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So I think it's an annual thing, but how many of these Lost Gym Sundances is this the, you know, 40-something edition?
No, just the second.
Yes, it's the second in a long series of two. So
yeah,
and we did it last year, and we thought we'd better do it at least for the last Sundance Festival 2026 scheduled to take place in Park City. And it was great to hear that the Institute is planning a legacy program of an assortment, a potpourri of films from Sundance's history. So we are, before the main course of the festival, we are kind of the appetizer. Well, with this series of four films, we are sort of the breadsticks before you get to the festival. It's a series for 4 months, and it starts this week.
November 7th.
Yeah,
tomorrow.
This Friday. Yeah, for 4 months, the first Friday of each month, we'll show our one of our lost gems, and the first one, and Destiny can talk a little bit more about that, but is an Australian picture called The Dish.
Yeah, what's interesting is, so the we're doing this with the Summit County Library of, you know, that's where I work at the Kimball Junction branch, and Dan Compton's a big supporter of film. He has a book to film series there. And so when we started thinking about showing some of the Sundance movies that we all really, really enjoyed, but they never really took off. I mean, some did, like The Dish obviously did well. So we wanted to show maybe some of the unknown ones, and that's how Lost Gems of Sundance came about. And the one that we're doing tomorrow night at 6 p.m., The Dish, it's very, very interesting. It is an Australian film with Sam Neill. I think it's very charming without being too sugary. And I think people will be interested to know, because I had never even known any of this until I saw it at Sundance in, I think, 2001. So when the moon landing happened, when the first step by Neil Armstrong was, you know, everyone was so excited, they realized that there was no way that they could broadcast that because of kind of the situation, unless they used this little known radio dish in Australia in this little town. And so we very nearly missed the first step of Neil Armstrong on the moon, which would have been like such a loss. And charming, great little film. I think everyone is really, really going to enjoy it. I know I've watched it a number of times. And this was picked out by Tom Heffron, who some people may remember was the listmaster when all the locals used to have to camp out overnight to get Sundance tickets. So this was one of his choices. And we kind of asked people, like, what do you like?
And you mentioned the Kimball Junction branch. Is that where people will see this?
Yes.
So they're not at the Santee?
No, okay. Alas. I'm a Summit County Library employee. I have great envy of the Santee Auditorium. I was there for many years with the film series, but we're in the auditorium there.
Okay. And then, of course, the other Lost Gem, or the next one, December 5th, will be Frozen. I'm curious who chose this. This is not the Disney version. This is the version where some unfortunate skiers are stuck on a ski lift and horror ensues.
Horror ensues. There was a review that said this movie will do for skiing what Jaws did for swimming. So I'm not quite sure it'll be that way, but this came out at the 2010 festival. It's not the Disney cartoon, and it's certainly not reflective of our fine, enjoyable Park City Ski Resort experience that you can obtain locally. This is set in a little resort. It's on the eastern seaboard. So you know, blame those guys for these three kids that end up in a stuck in a chairlift, and they have to get down. And even if they do get down, there may be wildlife challenges.
No powder to cushion your fall.
Yeah. The another local angle is that it was shot in the snow basin area of the film. This was the person who kind of chose this was our library director, Dan Compton. He kind of liked this, and I kind of liked the film too. I wanted to do a double feature. There was a Sundance picture called Open Water, which was about a squabbling married couple that go on a scuba diving expedition down in the Caribbean, and they accidentally get left behind in the middle of the ocean, surrounded by sharks. I wanted to have a double feature called You're Doomed. Have fun.
Yeah, you know? for the December season, Frozen's on December 5th at 6 p.m. So just think first Friday of each month.
Yes.
And on January 2nd, which, you know, is a little bit tough because it's so close after New Year's, but we're doing a great little film called Son of Rambo, and Mark Harrington.
Friday film reviewer.
Yeah, also. Big film head. He recommended this one, and I really enjoy it too. It's a British film about two young kids that, you know, maybe aren't very popular, and they decide that they want to do a little kind of amateur remake of First Blood. And so Son of Rambo, it's spelled R-A-M-B-O-W. Sly Stallone saw it. He gave it the approval. Again, charming but not too sugary. They get a French foreign exchange student involved, and all of a sudden these two young guys are part of the cool kids at school. So we have that one, Son of Rambo, January 2nd, 6 p.m.
Yeah, the thing to remember is first Friday of each month, you know, just look to see what the Kimball Library is showing in the Sundance Gem series. And the films are totally free, and 6 p.m.
The final one, February 6th, the whole shooting match. You're going to think I was born yesterday, but this looks like it didn't premiere at Sundance at all. It was the Utah U.S. Film Festival.
This goes back to the early infant stages of the film festival. And in a way, we can say that it was Robert Redford who picked out our last Sundance gem. This will play on the 6th, so this will be right after the last Sundance Film Festival in Park City. This goes back to 1978. The first effort at a film festival in Utah was held down in Salt Lake around the when the old Troy Square, the barns, were movie theaters. And the festival at that time had a small group of independent films, maybe half a dozen or something. One of the films that gathered acclaim there was The Whole Shootin' Match, which was made in Texas by an independent filmmaker named Eagle Pinnell. The story of two guys, two rednecks, are kind of hoping to find that scheme or that invention that'll make them millionaires. It's kind of comic, it's kind of dark, it's kind of bittersweet. It kind of looks into the soul of that kind of Texas redneck existing, you know, at that point in time. And the significance is that it's been reported that during the festival, Redford saw this film, and watching this movie, he was stirred to think, you know, we should have some kind of organization, entity, to help out these aspiring young filmmakers, you know, help them work on their direction and script. And so from this movie, this screening with Redford, it was a bit of the seed that gave birth later to the Sundance Institute, and Sundance later taking over the festival in 1985. There's even a small jokey reverence to Robert Redford. I would have loved to have seen his face when that came up in the movie. So I should also mention that we want to thank the distributor, Watchmaker Films, for allowing us to show the film. And this company is located, oddly enough, in Britain, and showing this movie out of Texas. But it was a movie that inspired Redford. It also inspired Richard Linklater, the Austin, Texas filmmaker. So we thought that to end the series, that we want to go back to the beginning. sort of the first, as I said, the seed that kind of started it all.
That's great. Yeah. I mean, Linklater's my favorite director, and on Redford, I'm curious, you know, what the Sundance will feel like for the two of you this year without Redford and with its departure. How, like, you know, what are you feeling going into the final year?
You know, it is interesting because people have asked, because back in the day, as Rick did, I used to see a lot of movies, and I kind of don't see as many. And I mean, I will always have such a fondness for Sundance. It probably changed a good 30 years of my life and put me in a direction that would have never happened if I hadn't been from Park City. And so many movies. I mean, I could list hundreds and hundreds of great movies that I love that never went anywhere. And we could do Lost Gems of Sundance for the next 50 years and not run out of great movies. And I just hope that they really make it special this year.
Yeah. Do you think you'll continue doing Lost Gems?
Yeah, it just depends. The Summit County Library is moving to a new building. Obviously, I would love to have a real theater to show movies in. We can't show movies, you know, past February and March and April because the light is too light in there. Let's get a nice theater going.
I would love to get to continue the Lost Gems even after the Sundance Festival leaves. Mm-hmm. It kind of depends on the turnout. You know, if we get a fairly healthy turnout for the film, the films, or if the audience is basically people that were there to renew their driver's licenses and they kind of wandered in to see what was going on. We'll have to see. I would love to see Lost Gems expand to take in not just fans from Park City, but from the Salt Lake area. Mm-hmm. I'd love, and if we ever got developed some kind of film festival in the future, we have to start from scratch now, I guess, but it would be nice to have a Utah Film Festival that would include a program of the Lost Gems of Sundance. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see that, you know, in the faraway future.
Yeah.
You could name it Slam Dance or something.
Well, what's interesting is we have such a great DVD collection at the Kimball Junction Library, and people will come in and say, like, give me some of your favorite Sundance DVDs. And there's lots. And so you could Lost Gems of Sundance yourself one night a week for years and years. So,
you know, Sundance fans are lucky enough to have Destiny at the library, mm-hmm. who is a longtime sort of, she is kind of a curator of the heritage of Sundance. And so it's great to have her at there assembling films and, you know, binge bundles,
yeah.
and themes of the, you know, Sundance, two or three films from Sundance that have a common theme and all that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And obviously we'll have information on how and where to see the films online, but any tickets or reservations required?
No, not at all. It's free. You know, people sometimes like to get there a little bit early so they can sit in their favorite seats, you know, because not being a true theater, it's, you know, flat level floor. Dan makes popcorn. You know, he's pretty diligent about that. He does his popcorn for his book to film series too. And then they have another Summit County film series over in Camas, the classic film series.
Yeah, the classic films. If you want to get to with a little group and look at some of the old classics of Hollywood, and theirs is, remember, the third Thursday of every month. Mm-hmm. And this month they're doing the classic screwball comedy, The Lady Eve, with Barbara Stanwyck and mm-hmm. Henry Fonda. So that's in a couple weeks.
All right.
Yeah.
Anything else y'all want to mention?
Well, no, just like this is such a film town, and there's people that really, really appreciate film. And feel free to roll into the Kimball Junction Library if you have a gem that you saw, you know, back in the day when maybe at the Egyptian Theater or something, and, you know, just mention it to us and we'll see what we can do about at least getting the DVD.
Yeah, I'd like to, Connor, I'd like to find out from you later on what if you have a gem that of your own that maybe we can find.
Give me 2 minutes to sign off. I have thoughts.
Yes.
All right. Destiny Groves, Rick Bruff, thank you so much for coming on air, as always.
Thank you.
This has been the Local News Hour on KPCW. I'm Connor Thomas, been filling in for Leslie this morning.